Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing a man with enough awards and accolades to make this podcast intro half an hour long. One of Australia's nicest and most prolific science fiction authors, Mr. Sean Williams. Welcome to the podcast, Sean.
Thanks, Sean, and thanks for your kind words. Nice to be here.
Okay, I was just thinking, in many ways, we share a similar upbringing. Both of us were born in isolated regional communities, and I think that upbringing confers some disadvantages, but also confers some unique opportunities. And I wanted to ask you what you felt were the best things about growing up in South Australia, where you did, and how did it shape you as a person and ultimately as a writer?
Well, they're all very interesting, very deep questions that I think I'm still processing as I get older through my writing, because writing is, of course, great therapy. I was born in Whyalla, in a remote country town, where my father was a country school teacher, and we travelled around a lot when I was very young. And I think that itinerant kind of lifestyle encouraged me to find a sense of home and continuity in the books that I was reading. So I think I was always going to be a reader. My parents were readers, and both my parents were school teachers, and they had a lot of books and they enjoyed reading. But I think I particularly gravitated to it because it was a way of you know, if things were difficult when I was moving around, I could always just read a book and I was fine. Give me a Doctor Who novel or Agatha Christie novel when I was 10 and I would be perfectly happy. So I think it gave me that great sense of loving books and loving stories. And I've spent most of my life in South Australia, apart from a brief stint in Victoria and a few years in Darwin when I was very young. And I think inevitably the landscape has kind of soaked into me in a weird sort of way. I mean, it certainly has in terms of my fantasy writing. Whenever I'm trying to write anything that's got a strong sense of place, I naturally gravitate to the landscapes of South Australia, which are very different landscapes to the kind of, inverted commas, Australian landscapes that you normally see on TV and film. You know, there's no no snowy mountains, there are no forests, there are no, you know, it's not that sort of mythic Australian kind of environment. It's very flat, as you know, very dry, very, very old. And I think that incredible sense of age just soaked into me when I was young. And it's a flavour that I've come to really appreciate. And a lot of people stand in the South Australian outback and think, this is really boring, there's nothing here. But it's so richly redolent with so many textures and small things, and it's a great contrast between the big and the small. And I think my writing really reflects that too. You know, I can write a giant space opera set millions of years in the future, but I'm also drawn to small things like the texture of a beach on the west coast. And South Australia is kind of like that. You know, it's this big, vast expanse, but if you look down really closely at it, it's full of life. And because it's so flat, because it's, you know, arguably so boring, I think that also encouraged me to use my imagination as well, and to kind of see beyond. I mean, I love Adelaide. I absolutely love it. But in a way, it's the perfect place to live if you want to be a writer, because the stereotypically exciting things happen elsewhere. You know, if you want to see, you know, massive firework displays, you go to Sydney on New Year's Eve. If you want to see giant skyscrapers, you go to New York. If you want to see things that are incredibly old, you go to Europe or England. Adelaide is just a big country town, where everyone kind of knows everybody else, everybody knows where they fit in, and you can, I come back here to work and to imagine things, and I love it. And I'm not sure that I've entirely answered your questions, but that's what it means to be a writer who's grown up in South Australia and wants to live here and work here for the rest of his life.
Actually, don't particularly care if you answer my question or not, because the answer was good. No, I think you did that well, and I was, when you were talking then, I just got an image then of, I can't remember the name of the documentary. It might have been First Footsteps, and they were talking. It's for the listeners, it's a DVD documentary on the first Australians, so Aboriginal people, and their interaction with the land. And I have this picture of this anthropologist, I think he was, and he was showing the viewer a map marked out in the rock, and he said, this is the oldest map anywhere in the world. And he said if you look at this, you would have known when this was made. Waterhole is over there. You know, just mapping out for the people that are walking from one side of, you know, from Western Australia to the East Coast. And I immediately thought, you know, there's a science fiction trope there. I'm sure that's been used 100 times. You know, these ancient alien maps, and yet here we have within Australia, you know, the original thing that the first people in this continent had laid down before them. Very simple, lasts 50,000-60,000 years. So, I mean, that's what I take away from particularly the Northern Territory and South Australia.
It's a fantastic symbol, isn't it? Isn't it? Because the past is a foreign country, but in lots of ways, if you go back far enough, it becomes an alien planet. And yet, you know, 60,000 years ago, people were drawing maps of their environment just like we are now, you know, finding their sense of place just the way we do now. It's quite incredible. I had no idea that existed. I'll have to track down that documentary. Thanks, Sean.
No, that's all right. I'll send it to you after the podcast. I'll put a link in the podcast as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah, because my reaction was the same. I thought, yes, that makes sense. Why have I never heard of this before? Okay, let's move on to your latest book, to be released very shortly, depending on when this podcast goes to air. It's called Jump, Twin Maker 1, or I believe Twin Maker in the US.
That's right.
It's your first foray, as far as I'm aware, into teen fiction. And I wanted to ask, what prompted you to write the story for the YA market?
Well, it's my first young adult novel in North America. It's not my first young adult novel, because the Books of the Change were written for young adult readers 13 years ago, but they've only been published in Australia. So, and this is also my first young adult science fiction novel. I know these seem like sort of tiny, tiny differences, you know, sort of hairline fractures between different genres, but it did make a big difference to me. Anybody who's been reading my work at all over the last 20 years knows that I'm really interested in mannotransmitters. So, and perhaps aren't quite aware of just how interested I am in them. So the very first short story I ever wrote was a mannotransmitter story. It was never published. It was terrible. One of my very first published short stories was a mannotransmitter story. My second novel was a mannotransmitter novel. I keep coming back to the idea over and over again. And in fact, I've just completed a PhD on mannotransmitters. So I'm hoping to be the world expert on that particular science fictional trope. So it's an idea that I keep coming back to over and over and over again, because it's in some ways the perfect idea for exploring all the things that make science fiction interesting. You know, science fiction is interesting because it can ask questions about humanity, about society, about everything. Every aspect of our lives we can ask questions about in science fiction. And with mannotransmitters, with that one device, you can interrogate all these particular areas. So it's an idea that I keep coming back to. And the idea that became Jump or Twin Maker has been kind of lurking around for a while, and I've been thinking about the best way to write it, or the best way to kind of place it, not in the market, but in terms of storytelling and characters and setting and all that sort of stuff. And I couldn't tell you exactly when I decided that it would fit best for a young adult audience, but once I realized that placing this particular idea, that an urban myth promising improvement, that if you perform a couple of simple kind of tasks while you're going through a mannotransmitter, you'll become better, faster, stronger, more beautiful, whatever. Once I thought that coupled with teenage, suddenly in lots of really interesting ways, and from that moment on, whenever I had that thought, it became a young adult novel, and I explored lots of different ways to tell the story. There's a character in there called Q. I was originally going to write the novel from that character's point of view, and I decided that was too distant. It wasn't immediate enough, so I then explored writing it from the point of view of another character called Jesse, who's in some ways the male protagonist, the male lead, and it was just stuck there for a while. It was an idea that wasn't going anywhere, and then I realized that it was actually Claire's story, the main character's story. And then once I had all those things in place, that this was an idea about a meme best explored through a female lead who was a teenager, that it all just kind of fell into place beautifully in my mind. You know, it felt like I woke up in the morning and had this perfect dream, and I thought, oh, this is fantastic, it's brilliant, it's going to be great. But of course, as soon as you start writing, it becomes a lot more complicated than that. but I think it was quite a long process. And this book, out of any book I've ever written, possibly ever since my first book, I've put more thought. I've considered it for longer, and in some ways put more of myself in it in terms of a commitment of time and energy. From go to woe, it's probably about 5 years of contemplating and thinking and drafting and redrafting. And I know it had 20 different rewrites and three different beginnings and three different endings. So out of all my books, this is the one that I think is not just the best, but is the one that I poured the most of me into. This is an idea that I feel really passionate about, characters I feel really passionate about, and I hope that readers will feel the same way in return.
Following on from what you've just answered, you've written across ages and across subgenres. What particular challenges did writing Jump throw in your way?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember. Well, one of the challenges was having time to do it. I'm used to writing very quickly. I'm used to thinking, this is how I'm going to write this book, and then just going off and doing it and fixing it later. One of the challenges was this one, was I had lots of time to think about it. And in some ways, you know, too much choice is a bad thing. you can get stuck if you have too many options. But I think one of the major challenges that I had with this book was writing from a teenage girl's point of view. I mean, I've written from the point of view of teenage girls and women before. In fact, I prefer writing for women. But writing a teenage girl point of view for what is likely to be a teenage girl audience threw up a whole new raft of pressures that I hadn't really confronted before, and it was a really interesting challenge. And I worked with a wonderful agent and a wonderful editor on getting the voice exactly right, and I learned a great deal about it. So that was a really fun and really interesting challenge. And I did actually ask my editor at one point. I said, "Do you think this would be written better if I wrote it from a first person viewpoint?" Because I was reading all these YA novels. I mean, I love YA novels, but I was particularly reading YA novels with female protagonists, and about 90% of them are first person. And I was thinking, well, if everybody else is doing it, then maybe I should too. And she said, "Sure, but how well do you think you can put yourself directly in the mind of a 15-year-old girl?" And I must admit, I shied away from that. So I kept it third person, which was how I'd written it. But I did write a bonus short story for the Australian edition, the Jump, which is written from a first-person viewpoint from one of Claire's friends. I really wanted to take up that challenge and try it, and I was very, very happy with the way it came out. So part of me thinks, what would Twin Maker have looked like if I'd written it from first-person in the end? But it would have been a different book, and I'm very happy with the way it is. Another challenge was trying to, as with any science fiction novel, trying to make the world feel complete. And in a novel that's a young adult thriller, that I wanted to really appeal to every young adult reader, I didn't want to stop and explain stuff at all, really. I know in any novel, it's good to stop and explain stuff and really set the scene and set the rules for how the world works. But I at the moment, I felt the pace dragging because I had to explain something science fictional. I had to find a way around that. I could either show the difference or the explanation would just have to go. And I'm pretty confident that anybody who's interested in science fiction and interested in picking apart this world will see that it all hangs together, even though I don't take the time to explain it very often on the page. In fact, I did consider briefly writing a second draft of the book, the sort of sci-fi geek boys version of the book, my version of the book, which has all the explanations in there about how the politics works, how currency works in a world where values are very different to ours, how the science of matter transmitters work. And very little of that is in the actual book, but I know how it works, and I considered writing an extra version that was 50,000 words longer, but then decided that no one would probably want to read that apart from me, and it would just confuse the market, so I didn't do it. But at some point, I might stick it on some blog posts, and so anybody's interested can read about it. So that was a huge challenge, and I really enjoyed that challenge. My last space opera series, Astropolis, I tried to write a punchy noir thriller set in a space opera universe. So there's very little explanation there, as well. And so I think that kind of helped, but this was harder. I've read sort of glance at the book every now and again, and I see points where I think, oh, should I have explained that a bit more? And I now know, no, restrain yourself.
I found when I was reading it that, I think you made the right choice. Not that you need me to tell you that.
Oh, thanks for that.
The pace of the novel is, it moves along. And I felt as though any time I had a question about the, the technology that was in the background that was underlying it, I was comforted because you either answered it with just enough information that I could go, he quite obviously has thought this through, and he hasn't gone to the extent of dropping in, half a page of text on it that I don't need to really know. It just feels right. So I think you made the right decision there.
Because that's what you want. That's what you want. You want the reader to think, to feel that it's right. You want that sense of verisimilitude, the sense that it's true, even if it's not. And I'm really pleased to hear you say that, because you want to create a world that's surprising and interesting but not alienating. And you want to present it in a way that's engaging, but not boring, and it's plausible but not boring, and it's so hard to find that balance, particularly when you're on the 18th draft of the book and you're thinking, if I cut this, will anything make sense? If I pull up this thread too much, will the whole world kind of unravel? And this is where editors and beta readers and all that sort of stuff is so important. So I'm glad you liked it, and I'm glad you found the pace good too, because I like writing thrillers, and I want people not to be able to put down the book. So if you have a boring bit in it, then you're risking the chance that you've lost the reader for the night. My ideal reader is somebody who starts the book at sort of 6 o'clock in the afternoon and is still reading at 6 o'clock in the morning. it's never happened.
Yeah, I find I can do that less and less as the older I get, though. Yeah.
Me too. It's a vehicle that keeps me up till 4 o'clock in the morning. But it does happen every now and again. It's always exciting when it does.
Now, the world of Jump, we're talking about a bit about the background now. It's post-scarcity because of the technologies involved, but it's also post-catastrophe. Yeah. And I thought, YA is known for its heavy use of dystopia, and I wondered if much of the background of this novel was trying to, go, that's been done to death, I want to go past that. So how much of that influenced, if it did at all, your decision to set Jump when you did?
One of the reasons why I set Jump the way it did was because I wanted a world that felt very much like now. So when you step out of Claire's house, it kind of looks like our world. There are no flying cars, there are no robots, there are no aliens walking around, but it has this one piece of amazing technology. And I can't write about a world that doesn't feel plausible to me, so I couldn't just go, well, let's just imagine that it's here now and see what happens. So I had to find a way to get from now to then in a way that kind of preserved the sort of superficial appearance of our world but enabled this technology to exist in it. And so to go from... To posit a catastrophe and then a technology that kind of saves us from it was a way of kind of sort of lowering the bar and then raising it to much the same spot in a way that felt plausible to me. I mean, I'm under no illusions that it would ever actually work like this. But in my head, I felt that it would be easy to accept. I think everyone is very used to the idea of an environmental apocalypse. So I didn't feel that I would need to explain what had happened. One of my readers, a very good reader, did say, I want to know what happened in the water wars. And I had to say, I don't want to tell that story. And that's another reason why I didn't do an apocalyptic story, because at the moment I'm not that interested in writing a story that's about an apocalypse. I wanted to write this story. But there are echoes of the apocalypse all the way through it. Claire's generation is... Her mother would have been the daughter of somebody who survived the water wars. And... although Claire is completely oblivious to it, her parents and grandparents aren't. So throughout the book, I wanted to sort of throw in little echoes of this past catastrophe that shapes the way her world works. So she lives in a post-scarcity world where she can have any physical thing she wants as long as it's been scanned and exists in the memory of a fabricator. But her grandparents still think of money as normal, you know. And her mother was raised in a world where DMAT wasn't quite as ubiquitous as it is now. And I think that generational difference is part of the textural background that you kind of create to make a world feel real. And hopefully it feels real partly because of that. But the more I kind of explore the world, the more depth and detail I can find in it, which for me says that it works. And once I'd settled on that particular way of getting around that problem, I stuck to it. But I feel quite ambivalent about the idea of the apocalypse or dystopia and utopia. Because we're never going to live in either, I suspect, you know. Mm. We talked about the past being a foreign country a moment ago. To a certain extent, the past was dystopic. You know, people got sick a lot more and they didn't have computers. And, if you look at it that particular way, you can say, well, the past was a horrible place. How awful to have lived there. But, of course, it wasn't dystopic for the people who lived there. They thought it was normal. And the same with us. You know, people looking back at our time will look back and think, this is awful. You know, how can people survive this? And people looking forward from the 19th century might look at us and say, this is utopia. You know, this is fantastic. Because we who live in it know that it isn't. It's just life. So I wanted to create a world that, for the people who live in it, is just life. And that's kind of where I started. I think that's the point where I started trying to work out Claire's world. I knew there would be people who would look at Twinmaker and say, this is a dystopic novel. And I'd have to say, no, actually, I don't think it is. And this is why. I mean, you can read it as a dystopic novel if you like. You can even read it as a utopic novel if you like. But to me, it's just a different version of life, a life that hasn't happened. And as I'm just coming to the end of the second book in the series, which explores the way the world is run more and certain issues regarding privacy and legality of identity and all that sort of stuff that will be, I'm sure, very challenging to some of my readers. But again, I refuse to go out on a limb and say this is a dystopia because this is happening. But I won't also say this is a utopia because this is happening. It's just complicated like things are in life. And as soon as you set up a perfect system that's right in for like 1 minute, you know, a minute later something changes and it starts to unravel and it just becomes life again. So does that make sense? Am I rambling? I should explain to your listeners that I actually have a terrible cold at the moment, so it's quite possible that I've slipped off into a feverish kind of fugue state. I'm just not making any sense at all.
No, you are quite clearly making sense to me.
I think your question's a really interesting one. And I think another reason why I made the world the way it is because part of me thinks it's really cool. You know, I love the idea of living in this world where you can go, you can step into a booth and just say, take me to Mum's house, you know, and then 2 minutes later I'll be at my mother's house in Wallaroo, just around the corner from where you live. And I also like that if they don't want to, you know, they don't have to cook or buy clothes. They can just dye a whole new set of clothes in the morning, recycle at the end of the night, and then do it again the next morning. I mean, the people still can cook if they want to, and they can still travel by means other than matter transmitters, but the choice is there. And I think the people who live in this world have a marvelous set of choices until those choices are taken away from them, of course, and that's where the story sits.
I had great... when you were talking about the abstainers or the stainers as its shortened slang form, I thought the lovely subculture that you developed there was quite good. In terms of utopias and dystopias, I think you probably summed up what my feelings are, that, as soon as it's somebody's utopia, somebody else is missing out, and it's a dystopia. So
yeah, that's right. It's true, isn't it? And it's interesting to imagine these things, and I think they're very important ideals to explore, and science fiction is a really fantastic way to explore those ideals. But me as a writer, you know, I'm not really going there, but that's okay. Other people are, and that's excellent. I'm glad you like the Stainers. I think the Stainers are really wonderful, and I often come back to them. I've written a whole bunch of short stories that are related to this particular world, and I plan to write a lot more. And the Stainers keep popping up because I think A, because they're a great texture to add to the world. I mean, writing about people who can do anything and have anything they want gets a little bit boring sometimes. And also writing about the breakdown of the system gets a bit repetitive after a while. So writing about how the outsiders in a world try to fit into a world that they don't want to fit into necessarily, it is really rewarding as a writer, I think, because you know, people who are at odds with the world around them are just inherently fascinating, I think. That's my take on it anyway.
Yeah, no, I think I might have a sympathy with the, I don't know, with the non-conformist, I think. that's what might attract me to them in particular.
In principle or in this world in specifically?
Oh, in both, I think. being a vegetarian, I would probably be an abstainer if I was in the world of Jump, I think.
Yeah, see, I'm although, not sure. And there's that scene where Claire's in the farmhouse and she's confronted with eating meat for the first time. And in fact, there's a scene earlier on where Jesse is cooking dinner for Claire and he remarks that eating meat is a victimless crime now because you don't have to kill anything to eat meat. You can just copy it in a fabber. So Claire is used to eating meat, but then later on she's confronted with a pig on a spit and she suddenly is, I can't eat that. That used to be a living thing. You know, the tension just in being a vegetarian in that world is interesting. I'm a vegetarian too, so I'm not sure exactly what I would do. It's interesting. And one of the interesting things about the book, the thing that underlies it and is kind of hidden there in the background, is the question of, what would you do if we had metatransmitters? And already, you know, weeks before the book comes out, I've had quite passionate discussions with people who insist they would never, ever go through a metatransmitter because if something takes you apart and then puts you back together somewhere else, you know, is that still you? Or is the original you dead and this is just a copy that's walking around thinking it's you? And that question, which lies underneath the entire series, is so fascinating and so interesting and elicits, as I said, such a passionate and different response. I could never stop talking about it. I work with a film collaborator, and she and I have been working on this idea in various forms many times. I think I'd go through it in a flash, and that creative conflict between us kind of plays out in this book over and over again. So you wouldn't go through it, is that what you're saying, Sean? You wouldn't go through it, but I would.
I don't know. I could be tempted, I think. But,
yeah, I mean, we drive around in these vehicles today that have giant chemical bombs behind us. You know, we put our kids on seats just millimetres in front of this giant chemical explosive incendiary fluid called petrol, and we build these stations in our suburbs that's full of, you know, bombs worth of this material. And we're fine with that because we get we get the benefit of driving around in cars. And maybe we'd be fine with taking apart too, if it meant being able to go to New York in 2 minutes, or the moon in 2 minutes. You know, I'd be tempted.
As long as you don't end up with two left feet.
Well, that's right, exactly. What if something goes wrong? And that's the question. That's the question behind every novel, and it's the question behind Twinmaker. What if something goes wrong?
Okay. Now, with the initial setup of the story, it features a love triangle of sorts. There's two girls in love with the one boy. Now, that's a setup that's not unfamiliar to readers of YA in particular, without revealing the story.
No spoilers.
Yeah, which is a bit hard to do. Why was it important to go with that setup?
The novel is, I mean, it's about metatransmitters, but at its heart, it's a story about friendship. And just as when you're approaching the idea of metatransmitters, you go, what happens if something goes wrong? The key question in Twinmaker in terms of the relationships is, what happens when something goes wrong? So, you know, one girl has a crush on her best friend's boyfriend. You know, it's a very, very old idea and it's been done a million times before. But how does it play out in this world? And how does Claire, this character, react to it? And how does her best friend react to it? How does the boy react to it? How does the other boy who has a crush on Claire react to it? You know, it's the crisis that I've always wanted to be at the start of this story, because the idea of improvement, the idea that you can write this note, stick it in your clothing and become prettier, you can get rid of your birthmark, you can change your nose, whatever, it ties into that idea. You know, if you're no teenager, no one is happy with the way they are, particularly teenagers who are changing constantly. And if you're in a relationship with someone and you sense that they're slipping away, you know, you can't help but look at yourself and say, if I were different, if I were better, if I were improved somehow, then maybe that person wouldn't slip away. So Claire's best friend faces that crisis, and she, in this world, she has the chance. I mean, she has this meme floating around telling her that maybe she can get this guy back by becoming a better person. You know, I wanted to explore that temptation secondhand. I mean, it's not written from Libby's point of view. It's written from Claire's point of view, but I think that key internal conflict is what kickstarts the whole story. The combination of an infidelity and a kind of a love triangle combined with this particular idea is what was the spark that started the story for me. Does that make sense? I think it is a cliche, and it is something that people have seen over and over again, but I hope that people won't have seen it play out this way ever before.
Well, having read the book, I know the answer to that question. I think listeners will have to read the book. There were some nasty surprises. That's all I'm going to say. It was a good start. I think.
I think starting off in a familiar way, and this is the other reason why I liked starting off that way, is it gave me a chance to say to people, here's the relational dynamic. You get this. It's set in this world that you've never seen before. So I'm going to tell you this familiar story, but while you're hearing it, you're getting all this new stuff kind of slipped in around the edges, you know. You're learning about DMAT, you're learning about Crashlanders, you're learning about Fabbers, you're learning about the air, you're learning about bumping and chatting and all this kind of stuff that is new. If I'd started off with something that was new on every front, I would have been afraid of a sort of overwhelming readers who, you know, don't like everything to be new. I mean, some readers love everything to be fresh and completely novel. Some don't. And of course, you have risks with that too. You know, some people will look at the beginning of the story and go, I know exactly where this is going, and may stop reading, or this is too familiar, I don't want to read anymore because, you know, I'll just be bored. But you can't please everyone.
No, that's true. No, I think it works as an works effectively as an anchor, as you've just explained there.
Thanks, Phil.
Now, I'll skip over a question. I'll come back to that. Depending on who you talk to, some regard YA as perceive it almost as books for children, and objecting to works that contain romance or violence or mature themes. And I'm pretty sure that wasn't what was originally intended with what the YA segment of the market. And I wondered when you were sitting down to write this for a YA audience, what was the age of the person that you were thinking of when you were writing?
That's an interesting question. When I was originally writing it, Claire was a teenager in high school. And so I was writing it for kind of 14 and up. But then later on, I decided to raise her age to an early university level, which meant that it would have been 15, 16 and or up. And then I changed it back down again because it didn't work as well. So the age range has changed quite a bit. The 14 and up is important, I think, because young adult fiction isn't just written for young adults. It has the word adult in the name of the genre. It's for everyone, and 60% of young adult novels are read by... No, hang on. The 60% of the market for young adult novels are actual adults, you know, between 25 and 35. So just because a book has a teenage protagonist doesn't mean that adults won't be interested in it as well, which is kind of a not terribly satisfactory way of saying that. Although I was aware of a 14-year-old audience, I was really writing it for myself. Because I love young adult fiction, you know, I really like it. I like a good romance, and I still remember what it was like to be 14, 15, 16, and sort of confused about who I was, and getting a lot of help and information and probably misinformation and stuff from books while I was that age. And I love the intensity of teenagers, both as readers and as characters in fiction, and as writers too. You know, young writers are incredible, the things they write and the things they come up with. And I think I wanted to be in that space. And of course, you can do that as an adult as well. But if I'd written if I'd set out to write an adult science fiction novel using the same ideas, it wouldn't have been as successful. I think these were the right ideas to include teenagers in as readers and to write to as a writer, if that makes sense. I'm not sure that sentence makes sense, but I hope that it does. This is a book that had very strong teenage concerns, and that I think are universal, and that's what I was trying to write too. In terms of the market, you know, I'm aware that some younger children will be reading it, and although it is a sort of violent book, and there people do die, and there are definitely some bits that I hope will make readers squeamish. I really hope that none of it's gratuitous. After I wrote it up to the university level, I did throw in references to sex that I then did take out later, because it just felt a bit icky for a younger character. And but apart from that, I didn't really censor myself. You know, the emotions are the same. Claire's reactions to the violence and everything are the same. Whether you're 16 or 60, I think if you're handed a gun for the first time in your life, I like to think that your reaction will be the same. A certain amount of nervousness and discomfort and unwillingness to use it, I hope.
Yeah, no, I certainly, with Claire and her reactions to things, I didn't find any disconnect there. I thought that, you know, that was pretty much when she hits somebody and successful, you know, she hurts her hand. And I mean, if you're an untrained person or even sometimes a trained person and you're striking somebody, that, you know, the outcome is not always 100% good for you, so I thought.
And in lots of ways, Claire is me. You know, I've never thrown a punch to anybody. I have no idea how to handle myself in those kind of situations. So, I mean, she's a lot smarter and more capable than I am. I don't want you to think that any of the good qualities she demonstrates throughout the course of the book come from me. But she has a very steep learning curve, and I was constantly trying to put myself into the position that she would find herself in and say, well, what would I do if running and hiding under a rock somewhere or hiding behind somebody bigger and stronger than me wasn't an option, what would I try and do? And Claire came up with much better answers than I would in the moment, which I think makes her admirable for me. I really admire Claire, and I like her as a character, and I really admire her journey, and I feel sorry for her. She has terrible things happen to her sometimes, and I hope that my love for Claire as a character, you know, comes through in the book. Again, I mean, everybody loves their books, and you always hope that people will love them as much as you do, just like you love your own kids. You know, you're very vulnerable when it comes out to the real world. But I think if you can't say that with sincerity about your books or your characters, then perhaps you're phoning it in. So I'm really pleased that I'm not with Claire. And I hope people like her as much as I do.
I'm sure they will. You've been a member of the Australian speculative fiction community for a considerable time. You're a fair way off being an elder statesman, though.
Not the young Turk I used to be, though.
But I was wondering, what have you observed being the biggest changes in our rather small community in Australia in your time? And I was wondering, what do you think we're doing well, or what do you think we're doing right? What's positive about the Australian community that you can see?
The thing I love about the Australian community now is that it feels, in a very real way, one community. When I made my first forays into it very, very nervously over 20 years ago, I did get the sense that there was a Melbourne crowd, there was a Sydney crowd, there was a crowd in Adelaide. I had no idea what was happening in Perth or Brisbane. I think the tyranny of distance really applied to fandom and the writing community at that point. Also, there were very, very few magazines. No major publisher was publishing science fiction and fantasy. There was no sense of an Australian market for professional writers, so you really had to go overseas if you wanted to, you know, be published that way. But over the years, influenced by people like Peter McNamara and Jack Dann and Garth Nix and they're all blokes, but I know there are women, Tansy Lane and Roberts, Kim Wilkins. There are so many great people who have kind of stepped up out of the wilderness in years, and perhaps with the help of the internet, and perhaps with the examples set by other people, formed this wonderful, closely knit community through conventions, through online forums, through you name it. If you want to connect with the science fiction community now, there are so many different ways to do it. And instead of causing infights and factionalism and feuds, it's done the exact opposite and made us one big happy family. I mean, you can, once upon a time, if you had a sort of a writing convention in Australia, you might have got 10, 15, 20 people there, partly because that might have been all the people who were writing in Australia at the time who knew each other, and partly because, no one would bother really travelling that far, perhaps. But now, you hold a writing convention in Canberra and you'll get 200 people there, and they'll all be published writers, and that... all at different stages in their careers. So there are old hacks like me, stumbling around, drinking too much, and there are young people, who are coming to their first convention, may have had their first professional sale. It's an amazing thing. Oh, Clarion South was another big thing that really helped as well. So the Australian branch of the Clarion Writers Foundation, is that the name of it? I think that's the name of it, that ran writers boot camps in Brisbane 2 or 3 times. That kind of community-building effort by really good people with their hearts in the right places, has such a far-reaching effect. So the biggest change now in the science fiction community for me is how big and how positive it is. It's wonderful. They're all good people. I count them all as my friends. I know that they're all helping each other in material ways, and I think that's amazing. And utterly unlike any other community I've ever belonged to. I'm talking it up a lot, aren't I? It must sound unreasonable, completely unbelievable to somebody outside it, but I think anybody who's in it, anybody who's experienced it as a newcomer. I mean, I experienced it to a certain extent when I would hate anybody to think that 20 years ago that I wasn't welcomed into the community, because I was. I was this green guy from Adelaide who didn't really know anything about anyone anywhere, and was given a huge amount of help by Sean McMullen, Damien Broderick, Peter McNamara. There were lots of people who kind of stepped up and said, I can tell you're really lost. Why don't you try this? Or let me give you a helping hand or a word in your ear. All greatly appreciated. And all you can do from then on is pay forward. And I see people paying forward over and over again now. It's a marvellous thing.
No, I'd agree with what you've said. I went to my first convention having, I was coming up to 2 years ago now, mm-hmm. and just about to go to one next year as well, the NatCon. And, being somebody who's spent a lot of time in isolated communities, sort of away from big cities and away from being able to get easily to conventions, that sort of thing, it was a completely open and friendly environment. So I think we're doing that as a community particularly well. That's not to say that there wouldn't be issues, but I think on the whole it's pretty good.
We're back to the discussion about utopias and dystopias again, aren't we? It's not perfect. There are people who don't like each other, and but I think we respect each other, and that's the main thing. I mean, I'm sure there are arguments happening in the background all the time, but it doesn't get in the way of what we do.
No. Speaking perhaps not of arguments, but of terse discussions, I sort of came in on the end of this, the diversity in SF discussion that was on the internet, in inverted commas. I was wanting to ask you, how well do you think we handle or promote diversity in Australian science fiction and fantasy? And I mean that in a pretty broad sense of the word, not just gender, but people of colour and non-Anglophone writers writing in English is what I'm looking at there. How do you think could we do a better job in that area, do you think?
My instinctive answer is always, we can always do a better job. But a more honest answer is that I'm not as up-to-date with the Australian writing scene as I would like to be. And that's one of the sad things about having such a rich and vibrant community, is there is so much stuff out there now, and I just can't keep up with it all. So I'm not sure exactly what's being published by who. I see a lot of women writers being published in Australia, which is just fantastic, and women publishers in Australia and editors as well. You know, when it comes to women of colour, when it comes to women of people of my cold has kicked in. I'm losing all my proper nouns. Gay, lesbian. What's the acronym? GLB.
Quiltbaggers, I think.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. whether they're represented well enough, I don't know. I think we can do better. I think we can do better. And I think that's not just Australia. I think worldwide. You know, it's wonderful to see some. One wonderful thing that happened last year was that all the guests of honour at all the conventions were all women of colour. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. We were trying to get writers for Adelaide Writers Week last year, and all the names I kept coming up with had already been snapped up by other conventions, and I thought that was fantastic. When has that ever happened before, that women of colour sort of filled all the top billing spots in Australian science fiction conventions and also writing festivals in Australia? You know, that is an absolutely brilliant development, but I'm sure there are other areas we have yet to address, and it's something that I'm aware of in my own writing. Claire, the main character of Twinmaker, is a young woman of colour, although it's not a book about race, but I wanted her to be a woman of colour, and there are other people of colour and throughout the book, and in the sequel there are people of indeterminate sexuality, and I'm interested. That's not a terribly satisfactory answer to your question, because I'm not as informed as I would like to be. I hope that's okay, Sean. I haven't come across sounding stupid, because as I get older, you know, I worry, you know, what kind of prejudices are creeping into my aging brain, and what am I blind to in my own writing that I just can't see? So I'd be grateful to anybody who said, do you realise this is what you're doing? Please stop it immediately, or perhaps think about doing it a different way.
No, and I think that's the right attitude to have. You know, one of the things about unconscious bias is you're not conscious of it.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
So when if you're open to somebody coming up to you and saying, "Do you realise what you've just said?" and you're going, "Up, oh, gee, that was bad," then I think that's all you can reasonably ask of people, because everyone I think has unconscious cultural biases and ways of viewing things. So,
and sometimes we just say stupid things. So just because you've said something, you know, sexist inadvertently, doesn't necessarily make you misogynist. It just means, hopefully, that you just said something stupid. And as long as you'll own up to it and apologise, you know, I think you're probably okay. Better not to have said it, but hopefully next time you won't say it. And that's the way I kind of approach it. Hopefully it works.
Oh, I think it does. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, your answers were so good that you answered about three of the questions that I had there. Good answers to my question, so I'm quite happy. I just wanted to say it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Sean. Thanks, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for letting me handle on in my cold fueled state.
That's right. I'm a fan of the Cood Street podcast, so I'm quite a fan of rambling. That's all right.
Good. They're great ramblers, those guys, aren't they? Two of my favourite people.
So, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity and wish you good luck with Jump.
Great, thank you very much. I hope anybody out there who reads it enjoys it.
Well, thank you, dear listener. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast. It's good night from me.
And good night from him. Cat's butt. That was the person I was trying to remember. I knew there was another woman. Oh, I'm devastated that I forgot Cat's name. Yeah, she's one of those great people who brought so many others together, not just through a gog, but through drinking in the bar.
Well, I'll tell you what, I can now cut this from the discussion and put it back in.
That's right.